Hello and welcome to the Women's Hour. I'm Kelly Pyle, your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster. Today's show features articles from the June 23rd edition of People Magazine, as well as the June edition of Real Simple. A few of the stories that I will share with you today include Barbara Walters' Shocking Wild Ride, Financial Frenemies, and Gloria Estefan on Love, Family, and 50 Years of Music. Barbara Walters' Shocking Wild Ride. A new documentary reveals the private side of the trailblazing journalist who overcame a troubled childhood and sexism to pave the way for so many women behind her, while never believing she was good enough. By Jillian Telling. This is from People Magazine. During Barbara Walters' long reign as the queen of the intimate tell-all interview, it was an honor to be the subject of one of her legendary sit-downs. It was perhaps an even greater honor to receive an exclusive invite to one of her legendary dinner parties held at her sprawling Fifth Avenue apartment in New York City. These were highly intentional guest lists, says ABC News executive producer David Sloan, a longtime friend, adding that Walters painstakingly curated the seating charts, placing notable guests like the Secretary of State next to a filmmaker, next to a fashion designer. They were people who were important, but who also might be important to her. Sloan notes that her wit and ability to schmooze with everyone she met was an art form, but behind her unrivaled technique was a painful insecurity. Her friend and former NBC correspondent Cynthia McFadden tells People. In the upcoming documentary, Barbara Walters' Tell Me Everything, which debuts on Hulu June 23rd, following its June 12th premiere at the Tribeca Festival, director Jackie Jesko explores the fascinating rise of Walters, who died in 2022 at age 93. The film, which features rare photos, archival videos, and new interviews with friends and colleagues like McFadden, Katie Couric, and Oprah Winfrey, also does a deep dive into Walters' tumultuous childhood, her battles with sexist male colleagues, and her messy personal life, all of which made her constantly doubt herself, right up to her retirement in 2014. Her road to success was paved with potholes and peril and naysayers, says Sloan. In the doc, Disney head Bob Iger says, whether it was her looks or her voice, just the fact that she was a woman, there were people who just didn't believe in her. She loved proving them wrong. There's no disputing that she led the way for women to be taken seriously in the newsroom during her decades-long career. As her pal Bette Midler says in the film, hers was one of the biggest lives ever lived. It was also a complicated one. Born and raised in Boston, Walters had an unsettled upbringing. Her older sister, Jacqueline, was born with mental disabilities. She was what we would probably call developmentally challenged today, Walters once told People, and her mother was emotionally distant as a result, a far cry from her larger-than-life father, a showman who ran a nightclub called the Latin Quarter, which was frequented by stars like Frank Sinatra, and later opened one in New York City. The hours Walters spent there with celebrities made her less in awe of them as a reporter. But when the nightclub business went belly up, the family lost everything. Walters had to go to work to support them. She took that responsibility very seriously, McFadden says, of Walters becoming the sole breadwinner. After regularly appearing on TV, beginning in 1964, she broke her first barrier a decade later when she became the first female co-host of NBC's Today Show. In 1976, ABC hired her as the network's first female nightly news co-anchor, opposite Harry Reisner. The men in the old boys club hated sharing the spotlight with a woman. Harry was downright rude to her, says McFadden. The film shows other male colleagues icing her out. I would walk into that studio, and Harry would be sitting with the stagehands, and they'd all crack jokes and ignore me. No one would talk to me. There was not a woman on the staff, Walters recalled in resurfaced commentary, also calling it the most painful period in my life. The abject sexism didn't deter her. She occasionally used her secret weapon, her feminine charm, to score coveted interviews with people like Egyptian President Anwar Sadat. Her tenacity in that space of that extreme patriarchy is really something to see, says Tell Me Everything producer and Imagine Documentaries president Sarah Bernstein. There's nothing quite like that footage of Barbara Walters pushing Walter Cronkite out of the way on that airplane tarmac to get to Anwar Sadat first. Despite the forces working against her, Walters proved to be a formidable interviewer. She asked the questions that nobody else asked, says Oprah Winfrey in the film. That wasn't always a good thing. Some of her interviews haven't aged well, McFadden says with a laugh, while Midler agrees that sometimes she got under people's skin with her blunt questions. In her very first special, taped in 1976, Walters asked Barbara Streisand, "Why didn't you have your nose fixed?" In another interview, she asked Vladimir Putin if he'd ever ordered anyone killed. She once looked Martha Stewart square in the eyes and said, "Martha, why do so many people hate you?" More recently, she told the Kardashians, "You don't really act. You don't really sing. You don't dance. You don't have any, forgive me, talent." Says McFadden, no one got out of a Barbara interview unscathed. Those who knew her best say she was just doing her job. "You've never seen someone more prepared," says Sloan of Walters, repeatedly going over her questions written on index cards. And she really changed the way people ask questions. Can you imagine sitting opposite Chris Christie, the then governor of New Jersey, who was running for president, and saying, "Aren't you too fat to be president?" But these were the things that the people watching at home on their sofas really wanted to know. While she relished probing the private lives of stars, Walters absolutely hated it when the tables were turned. Peter Gethers, who edited her 2008 autobiography, Audition, says, "She was fearless, except when it came to talking about herself. Her skill was making other people reveal personal things, but it was like pulling teeth trying to get her to self-analyze." He also notes the importance she placed on status. She was very attracted to power. She was very attracted to money. She liked people she shouldn't have liked because they were powerful, he says. In the movie, her gossip columnist friend Cindy Adams concurs. She didn't love you if you were nobody. You had to be somebody. Part of it may have been a need for validation. In her interviews, she was fearless in confronting people who had money and power. But in her real life, she really courted those people and wanted them to like her, Gethers says. A lot of her insecurity, some of her friends and colleagues suggest, came from fear that she'd lose everything, like her father did, no matter how hard she worked. It's a disease, says McFadden, when you can't enjoy your career because it's never enough. In addition to being underwhelmed by her own looks, in the documentary, Couric recalls her saying, "Oh, we're so alike. Neither of us is that attractive." Walters, who had 3 ex-husbands and 4 divorces, fretted that she was bad at marriage. McFadden says the happy marriage, children, and a big career seemed to be an impossibility for her. She used to give speeches and tell the crowd, "Women can have it all, just not all at the same time." She did make time for romances with high-profile men, like Virginia Senator John Warner, after his marriage to Elizabeth Taylor, former Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan, and Massachusetts Senator Edward W. Brooke III. She and Brooke had to keep their relationship a secret because he was black. Interracial dating wasn't widely accepted at the time, and married. Barbara had her fill of romance, Adams says at one point. She thought a lot of guys were very sexy. She was interested in the possibility of sex. She liked it. She liked men. On the home front, Walters became a mother in 1968 when she adopted her daughter Jackie with her second husband, Lee Goober, after suffering 3 miscarriages. She and Jackie butted heads, and as a teen, Jackie became a drug user and a runaway and was eventually sent to boarding school for troubled kids. They were just so dispositionally and physically unlike each other, says McFadden, who once interviewed Jackie for a segment about adoption. I asked her, "What was harder, being adopted or being Barbara Walters' daughter?" She immediately answered, "Being Barbara Walters' daughter." These days, Jackie stays firmly out of the spotlight. McFadden recalls that toward the end of Walters' career, when she was still appearing on her talk show, The View, Walters would ask friends if she could see photos of their kids and grandchildren with a sort of wistfulness. She'd tell everyone, "I so admire your relationship with your children," McFadden says. She was very regretful about her family life, and it was something she felt like she couldn't fix, so that was really tugging at her. Still, Gether says that after spending so much time with Walters working on her memoir, he firmly believes she lived the life she wanted to live. "I don't think Barbara really ever regretted anything." Love, marriage, and divorce. Walters was married to first husband Robert Katz from 1955 to 1957 before settling with theater producer Lee Goober from 1963 to 1976. The two shared daughter Jackie. She later married and divorced TV producer Merv Adelson twice between 1981 and 1992. Barbara's comfort zone. dictators, movie stars, and Taylor Swift. Fidel Castro, 1977. There is a certain charm about a dictator, Walters once said. Anwar Sadat and Menachem Begin, 1977. She did an unprecedented joint interview with Egyptian President Sadat and Israeli Prime Minister Begin. Katharine Hepburn, 1981. When Walters asked Katharine Hepburn if she ever wears skirts, Hepburn replied, "I'll wear one to your funeral." Donald Trump, 1987. Walters later challenged the then businessman for not having humility and being on the verge of bankruptcy. Oprah Winfrey, 1988. The talk show host cried while opening up about being a survivor of sexual abuse. The Kardashians, 2011. Walters bluntly pointed out that the reality stars, who were then on the verge of megastardom, don't have any talent during an exclusive interview. Taylor Swift, 2014. The singer was visibly displeased when Walters joked about her writing about men she dated. Her most complicated relationship. "I think it was a struggle," says Cynthia McFadden, who interviewed Walters' daughter, now 57, for a 2020 adoption special in 2001. It's not to say that they didn't both love each other, but it wasn't what Barbara had hoped for. You have been listening to Barbara Walters' Shocking Wild Ride from People Magazine. Real simple, right now. News you can use, timely tips, and a bit of fun. Do Good, Park Service. Did you know you can volunteer to help out at a national park? You can. For just a single day or longer. Your options include all sorts of things, like rebuilding trails, monitoring wildlife, and even serving as a campground host for visiting families. Learn more at nps.gov or search the site of a park near you. I Spy, throwing shade. When it comes to sunglasses, the darkness of the lenses is not an indication of UV protection, says Stephen T. Reed, a doctor of optometry and the president of the American Optometric Association. Your lenses need to block light, so try them on in front of a mirror. If you see your eyes easily, the lenses probably aren't effective enough. Add to cart. Clear the air. You may have heard you should throw open the windows and air out your home as much as possible to send indoor pollutants like cooking fumes and volatile organic compounds into the wind. But what if you suffer from allergies or chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or it's still a bit chilly out there? The COPD Foundation suggests getting a high-efficiency particulate air, HEPA, purifier. Breeze through realsimple.com/best air purifiers to shop our top-rated picks. Take care. Cool idea. A 2024 study of more than 1,000 women found that those who regularly swam in cold water around 60 degrees Fahrenheit with others reported significant improvements in menopausal symptoms, including mood swings and hot flashes. The results are likely due to the cumulative effects of nature, social time, exercise, and cold water, says Joyce Harper, PhD, the study's lead author and a scientist at the University College London. Still, I would advise anyone going through menopause to try a dip in an unheated pool or a cold ocean, lake, or river, and see how it makes them feel. Direct quote, Molly Sims' no-fail sleep strategy. I try to avoid falling asleep in harsh light from my phone or TV, which can be tricky because my kids and I want to watch every baking show known to mankind. But I've found that it just makes me spiral. I prefer to keep my environment dim and calming to prepare my body for sleep. Gabby Bernstein's meditations calm my mind, and silk eye masks block light completely, helping me stay asleep longer. From Molly Sims, expert snoozer, model, actor, and founder of YSE Beauty. Call to action. Minted plus Real Simple need you. In case you missed it, we recently launched a partnership with our friends at Minted. As our brilliant team starts pulling together designs for next year, we work way in advance, we're asking for your help. Go to minted.com/design-vote and cast your ballot for the stationery you most want to see in our collection. Our very own Lauren Lanati will be a guest judge. Instead of an I voted sticker, you'll get a special discount to take $25 off your order of $100 or more. You can even use that code to shop our current line at minted.com/real-simple. Voting is open August 13th, 2025 through August 27th, 2025. Book it. Maximize the fun. Known for her colorful, more is more spaces, designer Dani Daisy has just released her debut book, fittingly named The Maximalist. Inside, you'll find 16 of her boldest projects, plus lots of tips and a bit of real talk. I believe you should design a space you love in the here and now, she writes, not one that you think will still appeal to someone else at a future date. $45 at abramsbooks.com. My Recipes, Site to See, our favorite online recipe organizer. Ever wish there was one place online to store all your favorite recipes? Well, now there is, and we're obsessed. Just go to myrecipes.com, sign up for free, and you'll be able to save your faves to come back to over and over again. Currently, it works for Real Simple and our sister sites like Eating Well and Food and Wine, with many more to come. Health Watch, on the right track. Wearable fitness trackers have been proven to get us all moving more, thanks to inspiration and accountability. And new research shows they can be especially helpful for folks with type 2 diabetes. For the study, researchers recruited recently diagnosed people ranging in age from 40 to 75. The participants who got trackers and trainers ended up being the most active, which led to better blood sugar levels and a lower systolic blood pressure, says Katie Hesketh, a clinical exercise physiologist and co-author of the study. For what it's worth, our editors swear by the Apple Watch and the Oura Ring. 2025 Real Simple Home Preview. Things are getting real. The 8th annual Real Simple Home is underway. It's actually two homes. Let's take a peek at how it's been going. After finding our dream apartment building, the luxe 24-story One Park Row in Lower Manhattan, we fell in love with two spaces inside. One is a stunning two-story, four-bedroom penthouse, and the other is a fantastic two-bedroom apartment. Not wanting to choose between them, we decided to decorate both. We then teamed up with 10 creative minds and assigned them each a space. In June, the install starts. That means painting, wallpapering, and hauling in furniture and all the decorative stuff. The official photo shoot will happen in July, and you will get the big reveal in October. Again, we work way in advance. The transformation is wild to watch, so we're posting even more updates on our Insta, @real_simple. And if you're in the area this fall, you can take tours in real life. Learn more at realsimplehometour.com. Decorating tips, A+ advice from A-team designers. We asked a few real simple home designers to share some of their best pointers so you can decorate your own real simple home. Picking and hanging artwork. Get moody. What vibe are you going for? Drew Michael Scott, the Los Angeles-based DIYer behind Lone Fox, says this is an important question to ask yourself. For a calm bedroom, soothing landscapes or abstract pieces with soft tones work well. In a living room or dining room, bold, vibrant pieces can add energy. Think small. Gallery walls are still going strong, but Drew suggests trying one at a smaller scale, with only 2 or 3 pieces of art. His current go-tos? Tiny oil paintings. They're just so fun and can add a unique, personal touch to any space, he says. Consider hanging your cluster over a cafe table, near a sconce, or above a shelf. Or huge. A large statement piece can really elevate a space, says Chicago-based interior designer and stager Candace Griffin. Go big over the couch or a console table in a hallway, or really on any blank wall. Just pay attention to the height. The general rule is to hang art at eye level, usually around 57 to 60 inches from the floor. Choosing and using paint. Do a trial run. Give potential colors an audition, says Los Angeles-based interior designer Mandy Cheng. Get a sample pot and paint a square in a place that gets a good amount of natural light and in a place that doesn't, she says. Paint them at the bottom of a wall so you can see how the shade works with the floor. Mix up the sheens. Brooklyn-based DIYer Mallory Fletchall of Reserve Home chooses paint sheens based on the space. In living rooms and bedrooms, I usually stick with an eggshell or satin finish for the walls and semi-gloss for trim and doors, she says. High gloss, which withstands moisture, goes in bathrooms. Hit the fifth wall. I am a fan of painted ceilings. They can do a lot to change the mood of a room, Mallory says. She loves the look of a color-drenched room, all 5 walls painted the same shade, which creates a cozy atmosphere. Alternatively, painting the ceiling a darker hue can have a show-stopping effect. You have been listening to Real Simple Right Now from Real Simple Magazine. You are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer broadcaster, Kelly Pyle, and this is the Women's Hour. Smart money, financial frenemies. Can you and your savings survive these relationships? Yes, if you keep reading. By Naomi Barr from Real Simple. We all have them in our lives. People we care about who seem to be on a very different page from us when it comes to finances. Money is a heavy and hard subject embedded into our sense of self-worth, security, autonomy, and power. Our feelings around it are based on myriad factors from our upbringing and experiences, so our perspectives and practices are not always aligned with our friends and family members, leading to interactions that feel stressful or even undermining. We may sense that being around these people is bad for us and our bank balance, but it doesn't have to be that way. We asked experts to share some common financial negative influences and ways to improve our connection with them. The budget vampire. Who they are. This is the pal who makes reservations at the expensive new restaurant or plans extravagant birthday trips you feel pressured to attend. They're not afraid to spend on pricey experiences, and they want you to join in. It's always a good time until your credit card bill arrives. The fix. First, know your limits, says Stephanie Zepeda, PhD, a licensed marriage and family therapist in Houston who specializes in financial couples therapy. So many of my clients have no clue how much money goes toward discretionary spending, so we work on that, she adds. I typically recommend single people budget 5 to 10% of their post-tax take-home pay as fund money. For couples, it should be 10 to 20%. Crunching the numbers to get to a monthly figure helps you make decisions based on hard facts rather than emotions. You can then tell your friend you're down for a concert as long as you opt for the $150 seats rather than blowing $300 on the floor tickets. Or share up front that you're happy to drop $25, not $75, on a bottle of wine. Or offer an alternative, like making dinner at your place instead of eating out. If your friend pushes back on your suggestions, tell them you want to spend time together, just in a fun way that's stress-free for you both. The show-off. Who they are. They walk you through their latest reno and flag every wildly expensive thing. They don't think twice about sharing the amount of their bonus. They want you to ooh and ah, but you find yourself jealous, annoyed, or put off by their tackiness, or all of the above. The fix. Identify the feelings, envy, resentment, irritation, etc., that are triggered during a bragging session, as well as why you feel that way, Zepeda says. Maybe you feel jealous when people spend money on themselves because you have trouble spending on yourself, she says. Maybe you're bummed because their lifestyle is out of your reach. Or maybe you're a serious saver and feel a bit judgy about their extravagance. You can't know where your friend is coming from, so lead with empathy. Whether you suspect they're clueless about how often they steer the convo to money matters, they're looking for validation, they're out of touch, or they're overspending to fill a void. Maybe they're just really proud. No matter what, a compassionate, curious conversation is your best bet, says Megan McCoy, PhD, a licensed marriage and family therapist, certified financial therapist, and associate professor of personal financial planning at Kansas State University. Instead of expressing your envy or distaste, say something like, "I love hearing about your trips. They're so inspiring. Can you share how you budgeted for this one?" Their travels may come at the cost of eating every meal at home or racking up major debt, and you're not seeing the whole picture, McCoy says. If annoyance is more the issue for you, set boundaries. Instead of letting them go on and on about an over-the-top vacay, ask for three highlights. Or take bragging off the table entirely. You could gently express that you need a little less money talk, McCoy says. Share that you are working on some financial goals and think it would be helpful to limit conversations about spending, she says. It's up to you if you want to elaborate beyond that, but it could lead to an open and honest convo, which might be nice. The freeloader, who they are. Here we have your otherwise considerate friend who shows up to dinner parties empty-handed. They let you pick up the tab when you go out, promising to get it next time, then forget to. Or they ask to borrow money, saying they'll pay you back, but that Venmo never comes. Either they're strapped for cash, or they just don't appreciate the value of it, especially when it's yours. The fix. It's best to nip these situations in the bud, says Lindsay Brian Podvin, a licensed master social worker and certified financial therapist in Ann Arbor, Michigan, who has a suggested script. Try confirming plans for a movie date with, "I would love to go. I think it's your turn to pay." If you get the sense that there's a true financial hardship, Brian Podvin recommends coming up with an alternative, less pricey, or even free meetups. Have you let things go too far already? A direct conversation with warmth and compassion is in order. You want to invite your friend to share their perspective rather than assuming the worst about them, McCoy says. You might say, "I feel like I've been covering costs a lot recently, and I'm wondering if you see it the same way. Can we talk about the best way to split things up so I can feel a little less stressed about it?" Open-ended questions signal that you're willing to listen, which can prevent defensiveness and encourage genuine understanding, she explains. These talks might feel difficult at first, and you need to weigh the costs and benefits of having them, Brian Podvin says. If this is a friendship you really care about and you really value, then having a potentially awkward conversation is, no pun intended, totally worth it. You've been listening to Financial Frenemies from Real Simple Magazine. Gloria Estefan, love, family, and 50 years of music. The queen of Latin pop has found her own joyful rhythm in nearly a half century of marriage, in being a grandmother, and in her Cuban heritage. By Daniela Avila. This is a People magazine exclusive. After 5 decades in show business, Gloria Estefan is literally returning to her roots. Rices reminds us that we all are where we came from, and our culture is important to celebrate. It makes us who we are, Estefan, 67, says of her new Spanish language album, Rices, translation Roots, which was written primarily by her husband of 46 years, Emilio, 72. Estefan has been busy writing a musical with their daughter Emily, 30, so the singer, who with her husband struck pop Gold with their band Miami Sound Machine's 1985 hit, Conga, placed her trust in Emilio for the project. It's a very personal love story, says Estefan, who's also mom to son, Naib, 44. She's won 8 Grammy Awards, sold more than 100 million records, and earned the Presidential Medal of Freedom. But the icon, who immigrated to the U.S. from Cuba when she was 2, hasn't lost touch with who she is at her core. No matter how far you get in life, you're always that person, that little girl, that dreamer. Still, living her dreams, Estefan talks to people about her new music and life outside the spotlight. What inspired you to release another Spanish language album 18 years after 90 Mías? Emilio said to me, "Oh, I wrote you a love song." I go, "Babe, you're going to sing it?" He goes, "No, you're going to sing it for me." I go, "You write your own love song? I love that. I agree with every word he wrote." After 46 years of marriage, what is the secret to keeping the spark alive? Respect is a big part of it. Admiration, commitment. I feel like a lot of people give up too quickly. And for us, everything we've gone through has just deepened the experience. Every challenge, every tough moment, we've been there for each other. And we've been like an unbreakable wall. It helps that there's no egos. There's no competition. We just want what's best for each other. You wrote a song on the album dedicated to your grandson, Sasha, Naib's son, who is 12. What is your relationship like? We are super tight. We have the same sense of humor. We love the same things. We go to escape rooms, him and I alone, and we whip it. We win. From the moment he was born, I've made it a point to spend as much time as possible with him. He's the latest gift in our family and one that is the joy of my life. Emily is also a musician and publicly came out as gay in 2017. How did you react? I was very open to it, but I think she got a little confused because at the time that she came out to me, she was about to release her album. I told her, "Listen, are you 100% sure this is how you feel? I'll get on that parade float with you. But in the meantime, why don't you put out your music without any labels on it? Because people are going to label you. And if you're fine with that, that's good." I was trying to be both mom and give her advice on the music side. But we have absolutely no issue with Emily being gay at all. She's Emily, and that was always the case. People are people and have the right to love who they want to love. After 50 years of this career, what advice would you give your younger self if you could go back? Just be in the moment. Don't worry about anything else. Because time goes by so quickly, and a lot of my life is a blur. A lot of the times, I was just hanging on for dear life. So I would say, chillax, girl. Nothing is that important, especially after my accident. I think that was my biggest lesson. Not that I changed who I was, but the appreciation and gratitude. It freed me in a lot of ways, even singing. I wouldn't want to go through it again, but I wouldn't change it. You're so busy. How do you spend your downtime? I love boating. I love the ocean. I love nature. I love riding bikes. I love hanging with my grandson more than anything in the world. We love the same kind of movies. I'm a TV head, so I'll binge watch stuff. But that's usually late at night when Emilio is already asleep. I got my headphones on not to bug him. This album was a family affair. What was it like making your music video for La Vecina, No Se Na, with Emilio, your kids, and Sasha? I filmed it in the place where my mother and I first lived when we came to the United States. To go back to where I started, but now with this beautiful family and this career, was a blessing. Second Chance. On March 20th, 1990, a semi-truck crashed into Estevan's tour bus in Pennsylvania, leaving her with a broken back. She returned to the stage the next year after appearing on a June 1990 People cover. It freed me in a lot of ways. I wouldn't change it. Quote from Gloria Estevan on her near-fatal bus accident. Sharing her truth. I'm a private person. A lot of my innermost feelings pour into my music, Estevan says. Sometimes I feel that my fans might know me better than some of my friends. Finding sweet harmony. Estevan and Emilio in 1977 met at a jam session 2 years prior. Estevan was presented with two plaques to celebrate 50 years in music at her album release party on May 28th. My fans are super loyal, she says. You have been listening to a People magazine exclusive. Gloria Estevan, love, family, and nearly 50 years of music. Scoop, all the Hollywood news you need to know. Billy Joel says he's not dying as new doc reveals shocking secrets about his first marriage. By Rachel DeSantis from People. When Howard Stern grabbed dinner with longtime friend Billy Joel in late May, the Grammy-winning musician told the radio host that despite his diagnosis with a rare brain condition, all is well. He's doing fine. He does have issues, but he said, "You can tell people I'm not dying." Stern relayed in the June 3rd episode of his Sirius XM show. The news from Stern brought relief for fans of Joel, 76, who announced in May that he's recovering from normal pressure hydrocephalus, NPH, which forced him to cancel all upcoming concerts. The Piano Man singer once again made headlines on June 4th when he missed the Tribeca Festival premiere of the new documentary, Billy Joel and So It Goes, in New York City. The film, which will stream on HBO Max this summer, made a splash thanks to revelations about the rocker's early years, from a difficult childhood to the dramatic origins of his first marriage to Elizabeth Weber. She was married to Joel's best friend and bandmate, John Small, when they met. Amid the fallout, the star fell into a deep depression and twice attempted suicide, with his first attempt landing him in a days-long coma. I was depressed, I think to the point of almost being psychotic, Joel recalls in the doc. I was just in a lot of pain. And it was sort of like, why hang out? So I just thought I'd end it all. After seeking treatment, Joel eventually married Weber in 1973, They split 9 years later. Joel is now married to Alexis Roderick, 43, and the pair share daughters Della, 9, and Remy, 7. He is also dad to daughter Alexa, 39, with ex Christy Brinkley. Now focused on his health, Joel, a source tells People, is not retiring and hopes to be able to resume performing as his recovery progresses. With extra reporting by Alexandra Schoenfeld, you've been listening to Billy Joel Says He's Not Dying as New Doc Reveals Shocking Secrets About His First Marriage, from People. Nerding Out, Tattoos, dip into some strange and surprising facts about getting inked, by Jenny Brown from Real Simple Magazine. Humans figured out early on that our bodies work well as canvases, says Matt Lauder, PhD, an art historian at the University of Essex in England. Tattooing is definitely at least 5,300 years old, and it may be up to 100,000 years old, since all you need is something sharp and something to make pigment with. Though our Stone Age ancestors wouldn't have known this, tattoos stay in the skin because of white blood cells called macrophages, which dermatologist Arash Akhavan, MD, says you can imagine as little Pac-Mans. They come by to gobble up foreign substances and take them away to be processed. But when ink particles are too large, they can't carry them and just get stuck. Practice the world over, for various cultural and personal reasons, tattooing has left its mark on history as well as our bodies. Take a look. The Iceman Tattooeth. The earliest known tattooed person is Ötzi the Iceman, who died in the Alps around 3250 BCE. His body, frozen in glacial ice until 1991, is covered in 61 black lines. No one knows exactly why he got tattoos, but the most plausible explanation is that they were part of a healing ritual, says Lauder, author of Painted People and Tattoos, The Untold History of a Modern Art. Worlds and Words Collide. When British explorer Captain Cook voyaged to Polynesia in the late 1760s, tattooing had long been known as pricking or marking in English. From the native people, Cook and his crew learned the word tatau, likely an onomatopoeic expression for the islanders' tattooing method of tapping a mallet against a needle, Lauder notes, and brought the term back home, where it was anglicized into tattoo. It's electric. Before the industrial era, people would be laboriously tattooed by hand. By the end of the 19th century, tattooists realized they could move faster by repurposing the newfangled electrical devices coming on the market. Early tattoo machines were derived from a dental drill, doorbell, Thomas Edison's electric pen, anything that moved up and down electromagnetically, Lauder says. Pain points. No matter the method, tattooing hurts. The skin on top of important structures, like the heart, has more nerve endings, so the chest would be more painful than the thigh, says Akhavan, who does tattoo removal at the Dermatology and Laser Group in New York City. Speaking of which, people have been trying to remove tattoos for thousands of years, too. Another human universal, regret. with illustrations by Monica Garward. This is Tattoos from Real Simple Magazine. One last thing. Jim Gaffigan. The comedian, 58, created Father Time Bourbon, whose newest release is Middle Child Mystery. Last thing I do before I go on stage. I am a low energy person, so before a set, I drink coffee. I am such a slow talking Midwesterner, the pacing of a show is faster than I speak. Last time I scored husband points. I bring my wife, Jeannie, coffee every morning, but considering I travel constantly and she does 90% of all things for our 5 kids, it's very imbalanced. It's the least I can do. Last do-it-yourself project. I'm not that handy. If the TV doesn't work, I just don't watch TV. My wife's like, why don't you unplug and plug it back in? I'm like, that would mean standing up. Last game I played. Getting teenagers out of the house or out of bed on a weekend is a game. Do you blackmail? Do you motivate? Do you inspire? Or just go to full crazy? Last obsession, collecting bourbon. Unlike others, like antiques or even cars, which can be impressive, a bourbon collection is just concerning, right? I won't say the number of bottles because I don't want my wife to read this and realize how many I have. With reporting by Julie Jordan, this is Jim Gaffigan, One Last Thing, from People. Thanks for joining us today for the Women's Hour. My name is Kelly Pyle, and I am your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster. I hope you enjoyed the stories today on our program, and you'll make plans to join us again next week for another entertaining collection of women's magazine articles. And don't forget, you can take Sun Sounds with you. You can stream as well as access shows on demand on our new Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. Have a great day and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.